American media is a business, and it has a mission. Not to inform Americans, but to entertain them.
You know, there's happy news for happy people with happy problems.
And the business leaders said that they had to renew with vigor what they called the everlasting battle for the minds of men and indoctrinate citizens with a capitalist story.
Global corporations feeding us the news as they see fit.
Truth is subversive, it's anti-American.
Americans have computers in school, dozens of TV stations, and the most aggressive news media on Earth. Does that mean they're better informed? Hardly.
And it is a good day. This is Ryan Robson reporting to you from the Earthnet for Monday, September 19th, 2011. And you are listening to Newsreel, the WOG Global Sitrep on corporate political tyranny, technology, and trends for your headspace and timing. Rant Media is taking a stand for free speech today, and just by listening to this program, you are too. Also standing up for your free speech and joining me today is Misanthropic Gods.
You can follow all these news stories and check our facts by going to the Rant Media forums and looking under Newsreel for a post with today's date. You get there by going to smf.rantradio.com. This will be a free podcast. It can be heard on Rant Radio Talk, Galaxy 15 Radio, and recorded live in Second Life every Thursday night at 7 p.m. SL time at Grid Archers 155-74666. What we need most of all right now is your support. If you have something to send us, please email us at news@rostudios.org. That is news@rostudios.org. Joining us live in Second Life today, we have Morp Skytower, Legion Rosenman, and Anastasia Jennings. So, moving on here, we have, first thing is a little bit of feedback, and this was from, Jewel Verboven. If you could send me a phonetic pronunciation of your last name, I think I'm getting it right, but I might not be. But yeah, buddy, send me a phonetic pronunciation of your name, and we'll move on from there. But he asks, where can I find more info about the book you are making? Before and after shots of anything are always cool. And do not worry about pronouncing my last name correctly. So, yeah, I'll sort that out. But essentially what I'm doing again is I'm writing a book about Nike missile sites of the former Chicago Air Defensive Sector. And I'm doing before and after shots of everything, and I'm doing all kinds of stuff. You could refer to one of the earlier shows for that. But if you're looking for any information about Nike missiles or the history of the Nike missile program or anything like that, you can go to www.nikemissile.org. That is NikeMissile.org. And that's actually the website of the Nike Historical Society, which I'm a member of, and they have all kinds of information and all kinds of cool stuff there. So if you're looking for any of that information, just pop on over there.
That's very, very cool. I hope to see that book come out soon. And moving right along into the news. For our first story here, we got this from Jewel Verboven as well. In what could possibly go wrong news? World's first cancer-fighting virus, JX594. Scientists modified the vaccine virus, which is more famous for being used to develop a smallpox vaccine. Data just published in the journal Nature, suggests that an engineered oncolytic virus known as JX594 selectively targeted and destroyed cancer cells in patients without significantly affecting healthy tissue. The article in Nature by Breitbach et al. And the news release and the media release describe how JX594 works in cancer tissues after intravenous infusion. Apparently, normal tissues were not affected clinically. The initial group of 23 patients treated with JX594 were all patients with advanced treatment refractory solid tumors. Six of the eight patients given the two highest doses of JX594 saw their tumors stabilize or shrink. Seven of those eight patients showed evidence of viral replication within their tumors, but not in normal tissues. Cancer Research UK's Professor Nick Lemoine, also director of Barts Cancer Institute, said, "Viruses that multiply in just tumor cells, avoiding healthy cells, are showing real promise as a new biological approach to target hard-to-treat cancers. This new study is important because it shows that a virus previously used safely to vaccinate against smallpox in millions of people can now be modified to reach cancers throughout the bloodstream, even though the cancer has spread widely through the patient's body. It is particularly encouraging that responses were even seen in tumors like Mesothelioma. Yeah, I should be able to pronounce that, but I'm fucking up today. Cancer that can be particularly hard to treat. Now, despite the title there, I actually do support this kind of treatment, but it is a little bit funny to think about this getting out of hand and kind of terrifying at the same time.
Well, another thing that I'm worried about, you know, is even if this does do what it says it does, is this is going to get totally locked down by, you know, the pharmaceutical companies and everybody, because, you know, there's no money in a cure, there's only money in treatment. So, you know, I love to see, you know, cancer research especially getting published and getting put out there and letting people know that it's out there, and I hope that we'll be able to break past the whole pharma fascist bullshit and, you know, be able to actually have treat, you know, cancer drugs that'll work out there. But, you know, realistically, I don't see it happening anytime soon, unfortunately.
Well, another thing is, I always take a story like this with a grain of salt, because of the fact that, like, that the group they showed there being treated with this was actually quite small. And I mean, sometimes cancer does go into remission by itself. Sometimes other treatments or other things they're doing will also slow or halt the cancer. So we really can't say this is effective until we've got a much larger group that has shown a positive effect. So it's a good thing. I really do hope they continue with research in this area and that they show more promising results. But it's a little too early to jump the gun and say that it's going to be quashed by pharma fascism, which it probably will be if they can't make money on it. But it's still a little bit too early to make that call just yet. In a little bit scarier news here, we have exploding drone news thanks to Psychros. U.S. Army orders its first batch of suicide drones. Soldiers who fly hand-launched drone scouts to spot enemies in the battlefield may soon get a deadly robotic device capable of also delivering a knockout blow. The U.S. Army has ordered its first batch of small suicide drones that are capable of launching from a small tube, loitering in the sky, and then diving at a target upon command. The backpack-sized Switchblade drone has its launch tube given to individual soldiers a new level of has given individual soldiers a new level of precise control over an explosive weapon. Rather than calling in artillery support or airstrikes, soldiers can simply launch the Switchblade from out of sight, confirm a target on a live video feed from the drone, and then command the robotic device to arm itself and fly into the target at high speed. The unique capabilities provided by Switchblade Agile Munition for standoff engagement, accuracy, and controlled effects make it an ideal weapon for today's fight and U.S. military forces in the future, said Bill Nichols, Deputy Product Director at the Army's Close Combat Weapons System Project Office. Operators can even call off strikes at the last second after arming the Switchblade. This kind of control allows soldiers to retarget in case an enemy moves out of sight, or avoid collateral damage if a civilian wanders too close. The drone, created by AeroVironment, is able to fly in both autonomous robot mode, which scares the hell out of me, or as a remotely piloted air vehicle. Either way, its small size and quiet electric motor allow it to approach targets without warning. It can even switch off its motor and glide in for a stealthy attack. Just as our small unmanned aircraft systems provide game-changing reconnaissance abilities to ground forces, Switchblade provides a revolutionary rapid strike capability to protect our troops and give them a valuable new advantage in the battlefield, said Tom Herring, AeroVironment Senior Vice President and General Manager of Unmanned Aircraft Systems. AeroVironment received a $4.9 million contract from the Army's Close Combat Weapons Systems on June 29th. The company publicly announced the deal on September 1st.
Now, what this essentially does is, this is, you know, the same idea as, you know, all the other unmanned aerial vehicles, you know, especially ones that are armed and stuff. And essentially what it's doing is it's shrinking it down. So it's using this older technology and they're just shrinking it down and making it man-portable, which really is a big deal, you know? I mean, making something man-portable like this really puts it in the hands of the soldiers who need it, you know? They say here it's backpack size. That means you could throw it on a Humvee, you know? And really, in today's day and age, it's very rare, you know. In Afghanistan, there are lots of foot patrols done. In Iraq, there were almost no, you know, not terribly many foot patrols done. It was a lot of, you know, dismounted stuff, but there was still, you know, still vehicles close by. But you know, even then, you just have one guy in your squad with that on his back, and that, you know, that's an enormous advantage. It's essentially taking close air support and, you know, getting surgical strikes done with smaller vehicles. And unfortunately, you know, there are going to be plenty of mistakes with this, because, you know, instead of, you know, going through the whole clearance procedures and shit, like, you, and the whole time that it takes to do the whole close air support and stuff like that, you're going to have more people using this, which means that there's going to be more fuck-ups. So, you know, we kind of have to look at that, and we have to properly train people, and we also have to remember that they're human. So it is going to happen, but essentially it's going to save lives is what it's going to do. And I think it's really cool that we're going to have something man-portable that we can deploy, you know, quickly and easily, because one of the big problems over in Afghanistan stuff is actually getting close air support, especially if it's a busy day, you know, when there's shit going down all over the place. You know, CAS isn't always, you know, like 10 minutes away. It takes hours and hours if you're going to get it at all. So, you know, this really puts it in the hands of the soldiers, which is an outstanding development.
The one thing that scares the hell out of me with this particular robot is the fact it is a robot. Like, it's not just a remote-controlled aerial vehicle like most of these things are. They do say it can fly around autonomously. Now, flying around autonomously is kind of pointless unless it can at least acquire targets. Now, it probably can't actually engage targets itself right now, but that's only one step away. All you gotta do is, you know, once they're satisfied that these things is accurately identifying targets often enough, it's just one step away to give it the ability to arm and target itself. That scares the hell out of me, because that means that you don't have a man at the other end who can be like, oh shit, that's the wrong target, and hit the abort button. You have a robot that's gonna, you know, not care whether you're the wrong target or right target. You met the parameters, you're getting hit with a robot. And I also have this image of it silently gliding in through my window, landing in my bed, going peekaboo and exploding.
Now, you know, I think that it'll be, if it's ever going to happen, you know, I think it'll be a long time before they start, you know, making it where it targets things itself. I think that's kind of scary. You know, I like this project, but that's kind of scary if it's not able to right now, but in the future, I don't like that. You know, I think there should be, you know, human input in this here. There should be somebody making a decision somewhere, not a computer. But I think what they mean now is the whole robotic thing is they'd launch it if there was a firefight or something, and they'd have it up there, you know, waiting if there was a target of opportunity that they were able to get with it. And I think that then they would, you know, take it off of, or at least target, you know, laze a target with a laser designator or something, and it would automatically go there. But yeah, it's not automatically, you know, engaging targets right now by itself. But like you said, it is in the future, and that really does scare me as well.
Well, let's all hope that the independent hacker community finds some way to jam their signals so they can't target you when you're trying to run the fuck away from your house, which is exploding. In data protection news, thanks to Psychros, Senator introduces online security bill. Senator Richard Blumenthal, Democrat of Connecticut, introduced a new bill Thursday that aims to protect citizens' private information from online data breaches. The bill would also punish companies that are careless with customers' information. The goal of the proposed law is essentially to hold accountable the companies and entities that store personal information and personal data and to deliver data breaches. Senator Blumenthal said in a phone interview, "We are looking at past data breaches. I've been struck with how many are preventable." The new bill, called the Personal Data Protection and Breach Accountability Act of 2011, comes at a time when online privacy and security are hot topics in Congress. The White House has also been involved in discussions around new online privacy rules and legislation. The bill presented by Senator Blumenthal would also introduce regulations for companies that store data online for more than 10,000 people. These rules would require companies to follow specific storage guidelines and ensure that personal information is stored and protected. Companies do not adhere to these security guidelines will be subject to stiff fines. Senator Blumenthal was a vociferous critic of the Sony's handling of the attack on the servers earlier this year, which put data from 77 million customers at risk. At the time, the senator pressed Sony to disclose the extent of the damage and to notify customers who had been affected. If the new bill passes, Senator Blumenthal said, customers would be able to sue companies like Sony that do not take adequate precautions. The Sony data breach has become a poster child for why we need this law, he said. We were working on this legislation well before this data breach occurred, but Sony is a good example of why this law should exist.
I think that this bill here is a step in the right direction, but it's not particularly realistic, unfortunately, because I think one of the major problems that we have here is that people are willing to give all of their information away freely, you know, and you have it all the time, you know, sign up for this, but we want your name, you know, I mean, just look at Google+. They have that whole identity verification thing, and where they didn't want you to, or they would close down your account if they realized that you were using a pseudonym. So, you know, I mean, there's all these services that are requiring you to have, you know, credit card information or whatever, or just, you know, your name or a phone number or something to verify. Does that mean that all these companies are going to have to abide by these guidelines? I don't think it's going to happen. But, you know, I think it is a good step in the right direction. I think that, you know, companies should be accountable, you know, like Sony should be accountable for their customer data. You know, MasterCard should be accountable for their customer data. You know, companies like that, I think absolutely. But again, like I said, I don't think it's quite realistic.
I have mixed feelings about this bill. On the one hand, it is a good thing because the fact that a lot of companies really don't give a shit about their privacy of their customers. And they're just kind of, shoving off these data breaches like, oh, whatever, it's no big deal, it's not our data. On the other hand, it depends how technically worded this bill is. I don't think this sounds, but it sounds like the senator probably doesn't understand much, or congressman or whatever he is, doesn't understand much about the technical aspects behind this, otherwise he wouldn't be so surprised at how many are preventable. So I really hope that they got some good technical advisors in there so that they can base the law around what's actually possible, what's actually feasible, and make sure that places like, I don't know, a popular forum that doesn't store your personal information other than like your login details, hopefully they don't get nailed with this law too. And if that's the case, if they do technically word this properly, then this can be a very good thing, because it would, one, companies that have your information like credit cards, stuff like that, would be forced to protect it, and anyone who couldn't protect it would have to make sure that they didn't actually require that information for you to be part of their service. So that would slow down this whole give us your name, give us your address, and blah 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 that you see at all the sites now. If they can't afford to protect it, then they're not going to ask for it.
Anonymity is a good thing.
Agreed. In cyber refugee news, thanks to Psychros, Wi-Fi refugees shelter in West Virginia mountains. There are 5 billion mobile phone subscriptions worldwide, and advances in wireless technology make it increasingly difficult to escape the influence of mobile devices. But while most Americans seem to embrace continuous connectivity, some believe it is making them physically ill. Diane Shu is unable to hold back the tears as she describes how she once lived in a shielded cage to protect her from electromagnetic radiation caused by waves from wireless communications. It is a horrible thing to have to be a prisoner, she says. You have become a technological leper because you can't be around people. It's not that you would be contagious to them, it's that what they're carrying is harmful to you. Ms. Shu is one of an estimated 5% of Americans who believe they are suffering from electromagnetic hypersensitive, EHS, which they say is caused by exposure to electromagnetic fields typically created by mobile phones, Wi-Fi, and other electronic equipment. Of course, we've all heard about this, but this article goes into more detail about it. Symptoms range from acute headaches, skin burning, muscle twitching, and chronic pain. My face turns red, I get a headache, my vision changes, and it hurts to think. Last time I was exposed, I started getting chest pains. And to me, that's becoming life-threatening, Ms. Shu says. To alleviate the pain, her husband built an insulated living cage known as a Faraday cage. He covered the wooden frame with two layers of wire mesh and a door that could be sealed shut to prevent radio waves from entering. Diane spent much of her time inside of it, and sleeping on a twin mattress on a plywood base. At least I could see my husband on the outside, I could talk to him, she says. Diane believes her illness was triggered by emissions from a mobile phone mast. Her symptoms were so severe that she abandoned her family farm in the state of Iowa and moved to Green Bank, West Virginia, a tiny village of 143 residents in the heart of the Allegheny Mountains. Green Bank is part of the U.S. Radio Quiet Zone, where wireless is banned across 13,000 square miles, that's 33,000 square kilometers, to prevent transmissions from interfering with a number of radio telescopes in the area. The largest is owned by National Radio Astronomy Observatory and enables scientists to listen to low-level signals from different places in the universe. Others are operated by U.S. military and are a critical part of the government's spy network. As part of the radio blackout, the Quiet Zone has, as a result of the radio blackout, the Quiet Zone has become a haven for people like Diane, desperate to get away from wireless technology. The Wireless Association, CTIA, says that scientific evidence has overwhelmingly shows that wireless devices, with the limits established by government regulators, do not pose a public health risk or cause any adverse health effects. And the World Health Organization, while acknowledging the symptoms are genuine and can be severe, says EHS has no clear diagnostic criteria and there is no scientific basis to link EHS symptoms to EMF electromagnetic field exposure. Further, EHS is not a medical diagnosis, nor is it clear that it represents a single medical problem. However, new research by scientists at Louisiana State University, published by the International Journal of Neuroscience, claims to show that EHS can be caused by low-frequency electromagnetic fields found in the environment. The study provides direct evidence linking human symptoms with environmental factors, in this case EMF, said Dr. Andrew Mariano, a neurology professor who led the study. It's watershed in that regard. There have been no previous studies that scientifically assess whether electromagnetic fields in the environment could produce human symptoms. And the symptoms matter because they are the first steps that show EMFs produce human disease. Scientists conducted a number of tests on a 35-year-old physician who had diagnosed herself with EHS. She was seated on a wooden chair while voltage was applied to metal plates for pulses of 90 seconds to create a series of electromagnetic fields. The woman was asked to describe her symptoms after each exposure and after random sham exposures, and when unknown to her, there was no voltage. She reported headaches, pain, and muscle twitching during the genuine exposures, and no symptoms during the majority of the sham exposures. The scientists conclude that consistency could not be attributed to chance, but other experts disagree that links still exist. Again, that's a pretty small sample size. One person isn't enough for study. So a bit long there, but I read it all because they kind of explain both sides of this whole thing.
Well, I have a couple of problems with this story, and this is, you know, faults on the BBC, but 5% of the population is a freaking enormous number. Like, 5% of the U.S. population, that's a huge number. And B, you know, they call this the whole quote-unquote radio quiet zone because, well, you don't think that these frickin' radio telescopes and these, you know, big frickin' dishes aren't putting out EMF? Are you retarded? That's the reason why they don't want any broadcasts happening over here. There's a shit ton of EMF coming out of these, so it may be a radio quiet zone, but it's not an EMF-free zone at all, period. But, you know, I think a lot of this, now I'm not discrediting and saying that people may not be sensitive to this, because, you know, people are sensitive to a whole bunch of different things. There are people that are allergic to water, for Christ's sake. But, you know, I think that a lot of this is psychosomatic, and I think it's a lot of people that are, you know, freaking themselves out, and a lot of people that are, frankly, ignorant, is what it is people that are scared of it, and while they may be feeling something, I think a good majority of these people are just experiencing psychosomatic symptoms. So, that's what I think.
I tend to agree. If this is a real illness, 5% seems to be a pretty damn large number for this. And if you look at most of the symptoms are something that could easily have been made up or, not really made up, I shouldn't say that, but something that exists in your head and not really in reality, or something that can be caused by something else in your environment. The only one in there I really thought was a big deal, and if there is no other cause, it should be investigated, was the burns, which none of the people in this article said they got burns, but the article did say that some people reported burns, and if that's happening, and there's no other obvious reason why, then maybe there's something to this. But yeah, I don't think there's that many people who are probably that sensitive that they actually have to go into the radio quiet zone. And while you're right, there's going to be EMF everywhere on the planet. One, because of the fact our planet is basically a giant friggin' electromagnet. The quiet zones will have a lot less than everywhere else, just because of the fact that the radio telescope's primary function is to record, not transmit. So, I mean, even though there's still fields in the area, there wouldn't be as much as there would be, say, where I am right now in the middle of the city, where we got radio transmitters all around pumping out in the megawatt range.
Oh, very, very true, very true. You know, and another thing is, just kind of going off on a little bit of a tangent from this article, is we really do need to cut down on our freaking EMF emissions. Like, it's ridiculous the amount of shit we're pumping into the airwaves. And it does actually have an effect on the human body. I'm not going to deny that. It does have an effect on the human body, but it's also, you know, we don't want to pollute the shit out of our airwaves. You know, it's like if you go into a major city, you know, or a heavily populated area, especially a major city, you know, I'm talking about like New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, or anything like that. Like, whenever I'm driving around and I have like an FM transmitter or something in my car for my, you know, my chosen MP3 player, and I'm using that, I have a freaking impossible time to actually get the damn thing to work out here in Chicago. Because there's just so much radio shit all over the place. It's constantly overpowering my FM transmitter. I really do think we need to limit our EMF emissions here. We need to better shield our shit. And we need to stop, you know, just pumping all this frickin', you know, EMF out into the air. But, you know, I think, like I said, I think a lot of this article is, you know, not very well researched. And I think it's highly opinionated. But, you know, hey, it's just me. What the hell do I know?
But it is clearly highly opinionated, but they did inject in there both sides of the argument, which is why I read the whole thing. Otherwise, because if you go back and listen, at the very beginning there, they're very much on this lady's side, and they don't even mention that it's not a real diagnosis until later on. So it's something to be aware of, but as always, these writers aren't scientists, so take it with a grain of salt. In Rogue Arcology News, tallest squat in the world becomes an emblem of Venezuela housing crisis. A 45-story tall skyscraper in the Venezuela that the Venezuelan entrepreneur David Brillenberg began building in a booming financial center of Caracas in the early 1990s never did become an emblem of the abundance of the late owner intended it to be. A banking crisis truncated his dream, but 20 years later, the incomplete Torre Campanazas, I have no idea, or Torre de David, Tower of David, as it's most widely known, with staircases that lead nowhere and its ramps that spiral into infinity, is experiencing something of a renaissance, not as a home for a prosperous bank, but 2,500 squatters. The squat, thought to be the tallest anywhere in the world, is an eyesore for President Hugo Chavez and his supporters, a reminder that the basic housing for millions is a problem in their oil-rich country. 51% of the population lives in precarious shantytowns, with no access to basic services. In the capital city alone, there's a shortage of almost 400,000 houses. With little access to loans and a permissive attitude from the Chavista government towards land invasions and legal takeovers, squatting has become one of the few housing options people have. In the takeover of Torre de David, began 4 years ago when 300 people forced their way into a derelict building. The night we came in, I was scared, but I was also excited to finally have my own home, says Johnny Jimenez, 31, a member of the founding group and now one of the tower's main coordinators. We organized people according to their needs. The elderly can't go up flights of stairs, so they would go to the lower floors, and large families would get more space. Torre de David still lacks basic services, but the building functions well. Each of the 22 inhabited floors has coordinators, like Jimenez, who oversee the general functioning of their assigned areas. Yes, yes, Hispanic names. I'm not good with Hispanic names at all. The management of the building is divided into three departments: health services, recreation, and security. Space is granted free, but people pay a monthly fee of 150 bolar fuerte, £13, so it's probably around $20-$25. For improvements such as a recreation room for children, and an evangelical church being built on the ground floor. It is a city within a city, with corner shops on every floor, cyber cafes and apartments that double as hair salons and other types of informal businesses, says Leo Alvarez, a lawyer who has documented these informal settlements. It functions, and quite well, with no authority other than their pastor. Alexander Deza, or El Nino, is the evangelical pastor and the leader of the community, a label he resists. I've done all sorts of work here, from carrying sacks of cement to changing light bulbs. I've gained people's respect through example, like Jesus, like Che Guevara, he says. We have legalized everything. Nobody has tried to evict us. On the contrary, government officials are in favor of us. The future of Torre de David remains a contentious issue. Critics think it would be more profitable to restore the building to its intended use. With the money from the office spaces that like that, you could pay for houses that did have proper services for all the people who lived there, and more, said Jose Alejandro Santana, a professor of architecture at Venezuela's Central University. Mike Davis, urban theorist and author of Planet of Slums, thinks Torre de David is a testimony to acute housing shortage in Caracas, a problem, like crime, that has vexed the Chavez government. Despite official rhetoric, the regime has undertaken no serious redistribution of wealth in the cities and oil revenues. In the cities and oil revenues pay for many other programs and subsidies to leave room for new housing construction. Since the building has great potential, what interests me about Torre de David is that its emergent ecology with small businesses, jerry-rigged services, and it makes an obvious candidate for a green skyscraper experiment. Torre de David is far from a perfect home. No sewage system is in place. Lorry-delivered water is rationed, whole sections of the building are in dark, and the absence of lifts force people to walk up hundreds of stairs. In some units, the only thing separating its owners from a 30-meter, 98-foot drop is caution. And yet, to most of the inhabitants, conditions are better than what they previously had.
You know, this is extremely cyberpunk right here, you know? I mean, this is some really cool shit. And really, you know, man, Hugo Chavez, man, he totally messed up this country. I feel really bad for the Venezuelans, man. But, you know, good for these guys, you know? And that sounds like a really, really interesting building to live in. It sounds like they got something really cool going on there. But, you know, I really hate the fact that they have to, you know, squat in this abandoned freaking skyscraper just to get a home. But, you know, it sounds like they've made the best of it, you know? And I think that's really, really freaking cool. You know, they have power, they have food, they have, you know, internet, they have all kinds of stuff, you know? It's like they've taken modern living and incorporated it into this skyscraper, and they're all living there for, you know, essentially free, you know? They do work, you know, and everybody has to work to live there. And they, you know, everybody has, you know, assigned jobs and stuff like that, and that's kind of how they pay their rent. But, you know, it's coming back into their community and everything. So, you know, I think that's pretty damn cool what they're doing down there. You know, and again, I apologize for my Canadian friends' butchering of any Hispanic names. Yeah. So just as a note in the future, that's Jimenez and Guevara. Just so you know.
Okay, I don't deal with many Hispanic people where I am, so I really have no experience with the language. But I think this is actually
we'll give you a pass there because you're Canadian.
I think this is really cool here because of the fact that not only is this like a rogue slum in a building that's working quite well, it's not just anarchy in there like most slums would be. Most slums are kind of everyone's for themselves kind of thing. This, they've kind of made some sort of internal non-centralized government that everyone just kind of contributes to, rather than having someone lord over everyone else or having complete anarchy. And they've got a good system in place. Like I said, they've got healthcare that provided inside the building by residents. They've got security. It's probably not nearly as good as it would be in regular society, but it's a hell of a lot better than nothing. I have nothing but respect for these people for actually making this thing work.
Well, for sure, you know, they've made their own community, is what they've done, is they've essentially made their own city, you know, inside this, is their own little, you know, town, self-contained town, which is really badass, you know, and like you said, you know, I gotta give these people credit, that is, you know, extremely outstanding, and, you know, you wouldn't really see much like that in North America at all, you just wouldn't see it.
Well, you wouldn't see it, because the fact that the moment they find out you're living in there, the banks are gonna come kick you out.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess that's one thing about this crazy, you know, Hugo Chavez government there.
Yeah, they're probably just not kicking them out because they know they got no place to put them, kind of thing. If they kick them out, it's going to cause a bigger problem for the government than this is right now.
No, I don't think they really give a shit. I just don't think they want to go through the effort of, you know, picking, what was it, like 2,500 people more, you know, or more out of this building, you know, because they definitely have one hell of a fight on their hands.
One thing that I thought was funny in this article is that the one guy was saying they should kick everyone out of there and restore the building to its intended use so that they could make enough money to pay for enough homes for all these people. It's like, fuck, you know what? If that's what you're thinking about, then you obviously are either lying through your teeth or you have no idea how economies work. Because the moment you actually start making a profit off that building, I can guarantee whoever's getting that profit isn't going to hand it over so that these people can have their own homes.
Oh, hell no. You know, and what the hell was it doing before? It was just sitting there empty. So, you know, these people, you know, repurposed it, and they're using it for something good now instead of sitting there empty. I have to admit, though, that would be a really cool place to explore, and I know you'd probably have a blast doing parkour there.
I have a blast filming that place, going there and be like, hey, we got, like, a rogue arcology on the go. Let's, like, I don't know, give these people $100 and film something here. Moving right along, in space news. Amazon.com founder breaks silence about private spaceship crash. Amazon.com founder Jeff Bezos, or Bezos, I have no idea, suffered a setback to his ambition to develop a robust private spaceflight business when an unmanned spacecraft developed by his company Blue Origin was destroyed August 24th, shortly after takeoff in West Texas, the Wall Street Journal reports. Locals described an immense and terrible explosion reminiscent of the 1986 Challenger disaster, according to a source on the ground in Van Dorn, Texas, near the craft's top secret launch site, Forbes reports. The Forbes source report described what happened on August 24th. Rumor has it that it just blew up, but we don't have anything official, said senior Culberson County, Texas civil servant, senior Culberson County, Texas civil servant told Forbes. The Blue Origin's facility is remote. It is about 30 or 40 miles from Van Horn. People in town saw it and reported it and posted it on Facebook, added the official, who asked to remain anonymous for fear of repercussions. One said it was just like the Challenger, an explosion, then a stream of smoke in the sky. They won't tell us anything officially. The private space industry is so competitive and secretive. Debris were scattered all around the desert region and was picked up for analysis by Blue Origin analysts, according to government and industry officials cited by the Wall Street Journal. The journal emphasizes the enormous secrecy surrounding Blue Origin. The company didn't even reveal its existence or plans to the public until 3 years after its founding in 2000. But today, Jeff Bezos himself took to the company's blog to explain what happened to the experimental vertical takeoff and landing suborbital aircraft, dubbed the New Shepard, after Alan Shepard, the first American and NASA astronaut in space. As Bezos put it, 3 months ago, we successfully flew our second test vehicle in a short hop mission. And last week, we lost the vehicle during a developmental test at Mach 1.2 and at an altitude of 45,000 feet. The flight instability drove an angle of attack which triggered our range safety system to terminate thrust on the vehicle. Not the outcome any of us wanted, but we signed up for this to be hard, and the Blue Origin team is doing an outstanding job. We're already working on our next development vehicle. The billionaire entrepreneur posted a series of photos of the craft in various stages of flight and on the ground, signing off with the salutation Gratitum Ferociter, which is Latin for step-by-step, courageously, also Blue Origin's motto. So apparently they've been working on a space program for several years and just now are talking about an accident they had.
You know, the way that these guys are running it is they're running it more like, you know, a secret military, you know, like a Black Ops research project than they are, you know, a commercial space flight, you know, and they're essentially acting like the way Lockheed Martin and, like, Skunk Works does, essentially, is they're, you know, everything's super hush-hushed out, like, in the middle of the damn desert in Texas, and, you know, they're launching shit up, they said 45,000 feet, you know, that's well within, you know, like, commercial aircraft range there, you know, cruising altitude, which is, I think, 32 or 35,000 feet. You know, I'm not a pilot, so I don't know. But, you know, like, that's kind of scary that they would have something, you know, that secret that, the people in the town don't even know about that are, you know, just right there. And I think this is definitely an interesting article, and I think it's something to keep an eye on, you know, especially because, you know, because it's being run by Amazon, the founder of Amazon.com. So, you know, just kind of interesting, you know, and kind of this, it's almost like science fiction is what it's like, you know, this crazy guy who has this website, you know, goes all crazy and decides to build his own freaking private spacecraft and all that stuff.
As long as this isn't going to be used for nefarious purposes, which normally I would say it's a little bit conspiracy-ish, but the fact that they've kept a secret for so long makes me a little bit go, eh, what's going on here? As long as they're not doing anything crazy with it, I totally support this endeavor, because we need more space travel, and obviously NASA isn't the way to go these days. The government just doesn't want to fund them. So it's down to these private businesses that are going to try to find a way to profit off this, and unfortunately, profit seems to be the only way we're going to get into space. So I support these guys, and I really wish they wouldn't be so secretive about their spacecraft that are failing and blowing up at aircraft cruising altitude. But, you know, maybe they're trying to keep competition out of the loop or something like that.
No, I don't want to give the wrong idea that I think this is, you know, bad or wrong or anything like that. I'm with you right here that I totally support it, you know. I've said it before, you know, and you just said it again, is that, you know, essentially NASA's pretty much doomed. You know, we've pretty much put the headstone on NASA there, and, you know, we're playing taps, and so now we kind of have to rely on private companies to bring it up. You know, companies like this Blue Origin, or, you know, Weyland-Yutani, or, you know, those types of companies.
Well, you know, if Weyland-Yutani comes out, I'm not going to be on the first deep space flight they do. I really don't really want to be on the front edge of that one.
For sure.
Moving right along, in automated journalism news, thanks to the doctor. In case you wondered, a real human wrote this column. Ha ha ha, you know, journalists trying to be funny. Wisconsin appears to be in the driver's seat en route to win as it leads 51-10 after the third quarter. Wisconsin added to its lead. Russell Wilson found Jacob Peterson for an 8-yard touchdown, made the score 44-3. Those words began a news brief written in 60 seconds within 60 seconds of the end of the third quarter in the Wisconsin-UNLV football game earlier this month. It may not seem like much, but they were written by a computer. The clever code is a handiwork of Narrative Science, a startup in Evanston, Illinois, that offers proof of the progress of artificial intelligence, the ability of computers to mimic human reasoning. The company's software takes data like that from sports statistics, company financial reports, and housing stats and sales, and turns it into articles. For years, programmers have experimented with software that wrote such articles, typically for sports events, but these efforts had a formulaic, fill-in-the-blank style, and they read as if a machine wrote them. But Narrative Science is based on more than a decade of research, led by the company's founders, Chris Hammond and Larry Bernhardt, co-founders of the Intelligent Laboratory and Northwestern University, which holds stake in the company. And articles produced by Narrative Sciences are different. I thought it was magic, said Roger Lee, a general partner of Battery Ventures, which led a $6 million investment in a company earlier this year. It's as if a human wrote it. Experts in artificial intelligence and language are also impressed, if less enthralled. Oren Etzioni, a computer scientist at the University of Washington, says the quality of the narrative produced was quite good. It was as if written by a human, if not an accomplished wordsmith. The innovative work at Narrative Sciences raises the broader issue of whether such applications of artificial intelligence will mainly assist human workers or replace them. Technology is already undermining the economics of traditional journalism. Online advertising, while on the rise, has not offset the decline in print advertising. But will robot journalists replace flesh and blood reporters in the newsroom? The leaders of Narrative Science emphasize that their technology would primarily be a low-cost tool for publications to expand and enrich coverage when editorial budgets are under pressure. The company, founded last year, has 20 customers so far. Several are still experimenting with technology, and Stuart Frankel, the chief executive of Narrative Science, wouldn't name them. They include newspaper chains seeking to offer automated summary articles for more extensive coverage of local youth sports and to generate articles about the quarterly financial results of local public companies. Mostly, we're doing things that would not be done otherwise, Mr. Frankel says.
This is just a little bit scary, you know, but the thing that really made me chuckle here is how they said the quality of the narrative produced was quite good, as if written by a human, if not an accomplished wordsmith. And the thing that kind of amused me is that, you know, a lot of these news articles and stuff, you know, especially quite a few that seem to end up here, you know, some quirky, weird alternative articles, is they're actually written extremely poorly. So I'm sure that this isn't going to be much, you know, much. It actually might be a little bit better than some of the articles that we have here, you know. But I'm not sure if outsourcing journalism to, you know, computers is really a good idea. I can understand that for collating the data and for, you know, collecting it. But I'm not sure about actually, you know, publishing it. Just bing, bang, boom, you know, here it is, okay, you know, the editor-in-chief looks over it, goes, okay, this is fine, you know, stamp of approval, boom, done, you know. Especially, you know, how they're talking about quarterly financial results of local public companies, you know. Again, this is technology. Technology can be, you know, manipulated, you know, very easily by people who know how. And we could be ending up publishing data that's not correct, and, you know, it wouldn't have, you know, nobody would be able to look over it and say, okay, you know, they're just going to let it just fly under the radar. Okay, yeah, the computer did it. It must be right. But, you know, again, you don't get perfect results with humans either. You know, humans can be bought. Humans can be manipulated as well. But I think, you know, generally having people looking at it is a good idea as well, you know?
Yeah, well, judging by the first line of the article there, that was written by the computer. I think Fox News is already written by computers. That would seem to make sense here. But I like how they're saying, if not an accomplished wordsmith. It's like, no. An accomplished wordsmith has prose. This is just data being spit out. And the thing is, this isn't going to replace reporters anytime soon, because by the way I'm understanding it, is they throw a bunch of variables in. They take up all this information and throw it in the computer. The computer just arranges it in such a way that would make sense to a human and spits it back out. Now, they may have gotten the technology a lot better, so it sounds more like a person wrote it rather than just a list of statistics. But still, like, you can't take really variable subjective data that needs interpretation and throw it in there, otherwise it's going to spit out something weird. At least, unless they've got really, really good code that I'm not aware of. So, it's not at any risk of replacing any reporters as it is right now. It is a useful tool, but I definitely think that we should keep someone reading it before it goes out print, because, I mean, the computer doesn't care, it doesn't think, it's gonna make mistakes.
Well, you know, a part of this whole program, or this whole, news program that we have here, is it's not to, you know, yes, it's to report on the news now, but it's also to, you know, theorize and look in the future and see what's coming. So, you know, it may not be replacing people now, but we'll give it 10 years and we'll see what's going on. But moving on to Recomedia here, and I found this on the BBC, and this is quite interesting, I thought. It's Inside Japan's Nuclear Ghost Zone. Okay, well, what this essentially is this is, you know, a video showing what it's like inside the exclusion zone around the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant in Japan. It's a 20-kilometer exclusion zone that's quite like, you know, quite akin to the exclusion zone around Pripyat and the Chernobyl nuclear reactor in the Ukraine. And it's some of the same type of stuff, you know. It's totally abandoned. Is they have, you know, no press, no civilians are supposed to be there. There's the one guy that's living in this one town called Tomioka, a community of 16,000 that's now completely empty. There's, you know, animals running, feral animals, you know, that were former farm animals running around. You know, there's dead animals in the street. You know, there's damage from the floods and everything else still left over there. And it's just, you know, completely a ghost town. So it's really interesting to see this this new exclusion zone around the Fukushima Daiichi plant and comparing it to Chernobyl. And they are quite different, you know, because Chernobyl was spewing out, you know, actively reacting. I don't even know if that's correct there, but it was spewing out reacting material. And this is, you know, just this is different. There wasn't any, you know, reacting material that was blown blown out all over the place. So this is just, you know, residual radiation and essentially fallout from it. And so I thought this video was quite interesting. And then what else we have here is Graves tell the story of the forgotten battle of Fromelles. Archaeologists, DNA experts, and forensic anthropologists have recovered remains, which they hope will allow them to identify those who fell at Fromelles. The Battle of Fromelles, sometimes known as the Action at Fromelles, or the Battle of Fleurbaix? Yeah, sorry, I don't know how to pronounce that. I don't speak French, sorry. I'm about as bad as Hugo is with Hispanic names there. But though the correct title bestowed by the Battlefields Nomenclature Committee in 1922 is the Attack at Fromelles, occurred in France on July 19th through 20th, 1916, during World War I. The action was intended partly as a diversion from the Battle of the Somme that was taking place about 80 kilometers, that's 50 miles to us Americans who had the imperial system here, to the south. So this was just an interesting little video here, and a couple of links, and it's pretty cool, you know, and it's definitely good to research our history, and World War One especially, because, you know, while everybody's done a lot of research about World War Two, not too many people these days remember World War One. And my great-grandfather fought in France, and he received a Purple Heart in France during World War One, so, you know, it definitely struck home to me. And now what we have next is, thanks to the doctor, Number Stations Complications Part 1 and 2. And a net label based out of Barcelona called the Public Spaces Lab has published two compilations of songs which were inspired and based partly upon the broadcast of Number Stations. The article has links to the two SoundCloud pages from which you could download the two compilations. All of the songs have a Creative Commons attribution, non-commercial, non-derivatives version 3.0 license, so it would also fit your call for free music to either suggest or use as background music for Newsreel 2.0.
Yeah, I forgot to cut so that
this
part out.
This is from the doctor. Yeah, and it's kind of written weird, so excuse me here. But yeah, this is pretty interesting. And if you haven't done any research about Number Stations, is there, you know, secret radio stations that are broadcasting in shortwave frequencies? They're, you know, broadcasting either automated strings of numbers or people, you know, speaking numbers, strings of numbers out, and they're one-time use codes, so they're damn near impossible to break. And they actually, one of the most famous ones is Atencion Atencion, which is operated out of Havana, Cuba. And there were actually people arrested here in the U.S. a couple of years back that were receiving these, that were actually Cuban agents that were receiving these, and they were actually able to break the code for those messages. And they were then arrested. And so, yeah, you can also go to the Conet project, I believe, which actually has raw recordings of all of the Number Stations as well. So if you're interested and you listen to these songs and you're interested in that, check out the Conet project as well. Very interesting stuff, very creepy. Don't listen to it while you're going to sleep. But next we have a couple of documentary films explaining how money works. And this is, again, thanks to Jewel Verboven. And this is Hugo's note here. Do you want to say it?
Yeah, sure. I haven't had a ton to watch any of these, so I can't vouch for how good or accurate these are. But since Jewel sends us a lot of good stuff anyway, I'm going to throw it in, because I trust his judgment.
Okay, now moving on to Cyberpunk Kit. Swindon girl Chloe Holmes gets bionic fingers thanks to Jewel Verboven. And so it's another video from him here. And a schoolgirl from Swindon has become the youngest person in Europe to be fitted with bionic fingers. So that's really badass there. You know, good on you. You know, go hard with that. You know, don't let up. Keep pushing to try and make it better. Daily hack today is build your own CT scanner. And this was got from Hackett. I got this from Hackaday earlier. And Linus built himself an X-ray generator for a scholarship contest. We assume that this wasn't enough of a challenge for him, because after the X-ray generator was done, he used his project to model objects in 3D. It's an amazing build, leaving us feeling sorry for the guy that came in second place to his homemade CT scanner. The theory behind a CT scanner is fairly simple. It takes a series of X-rays of an object around an axis of rotation. From there, it's a fairly simple matter to digitize the X-ray images to produce a 3D model. The hard part is building the X-ray generator. Linus used directional X-ray tubes, a few power supplies from what we can gather, and what we can gather X-ray film instead of a CCD sensor. The film was scanned to a computer and reassembled to get a 3D image. Linus didn't seem too keen on giving away the schematics for his build to any old joker on the internet because of the high voltage and radiation components, but still, you know, it's really amazing and really cool, and it shows what you can do if you're properly motivated and you have the right knowledge set. You know, you can check out the YouTube demo. Of his scanner imaging an old computer mouse and the reconstruction of the same data done in MATLAB.
Stuff like that just reminds us we live in the goddamn future. Don't worry, we'll be back next week to make sure you can get the news you need to survive. If you cannot contribute to the show, please distribute it. We'd like to thank the Army of Flying Monkeys for their assistance in gathering data. If you have any news stories or pertinent information you want to send us, you can reach us at news@rostudios.org. That's news@rostudios.org. If you like the music in the background, check out the Kardashev Scale by Graydon Square. We fade out now with a track called Ambush in Rattlesnake Gulch by Brian Boyko. This is a free track sent in by Jewel Verboven. Remember, everyone, we'll never defeat the enemy if we're at each other's throats, so until next time, that's what server said. End of line. We'll be right back.